We've been hearing for at least 2 years about the trouble Europe is in, the debt crisis in Greece, Spain, Portugal, Ireland, and beyond, is now challenging this federation of nations and economies to share the solutions to problems that have proven worse than individual countries who took greater risks than their more prudent neighbors. What brought on this crisis after Europe seemed to have fared much better than the U.S. in the early stages of this prolonged crash? How close are they to solving it? How close are they to blowing it? And what would Stephen Hill's advice be? What does it mean for the rest of the world and for the U.S. in particular? While the bad news of this euro crisis makes headlines in the U.S., what has not made headlines is the good news contained in Hill's 2010 book, Europe's Promise, Why the European Way is the Best Hope for an Insecure Age. And I want to check in with Hill about the current state of that promise. Closer to home, Stephen Hill believes that America's recent economic collapse was preceded by a longer-term political collapse. The U.S. political system offers, are you ready, partisan polarization, a rigidly divided Congress, superficial debate, paralysis in the face of global challenges, and even before the economic crisis, the U.S. faced choiceless elections, out-of-control campaign spending, a filibuster-wild U.S. Senate, mindless media, and a partisan Supreme Court. As the middle collapses and partisans take over, America's frustration grows. Witness the Tea Party and the 99%. In a brand new 2012 election edition of his 2006 book, Stephen Hill renews his 10 Steps to Repair American Democracy. Stephen Hill, the former director of political reform program of the New America Foundation and co-founder of the Center for Voting and Democracy, is the author of Fixing Elections, The Failure of America's Winner-Take-All Politics, Europe's Promise, and his newest, the 2012 election edition of 10 Steps to Repair American Democracy. Welcome, Stephen Hill.
It's a great pleasure. Thank you, Terrence.
Okay. I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the work and the ideas that we talk about. So could you briefly just talk about your personal path, Stephen, to the work that you're doing today, and feel free to cite mentors or turning points or moments of decision, you know, forks in the road, that sort of thing.
Sure. Well, I've been involved in politics in one way or another for over 20 years. A lot of it was involved in Rainbow Coalition type work in the late 80s. And before that, even, was very involved in the mid 80s in solidarity work with Central America. And sort of became frustrated with politicians, especially in the Democratic Party, and how they seemed to give lip service to certain good ideas, but then never did anything. And so then became very involved in political reform. How do we change the system to make sure that both we elect better people and that we can hold them accountable? And began working on things like proportional representation, instant runoff voting, or ranked choice voting, as it's called, sometimes public financing of campaigns, automatic voter registration. I was very involved in an effort that passed a law in California to lower the voter registration age to 17, which we passed a couple of years ago. So that became very much a focus of mine, and that also naturally led me to start looking at what other countries do. How is it that, for example, in Germany and Sweden and other countries, they have multi-party democracy? They could have minor parties that not only run and get out there, get their candidates out there, but they actually run and win. And that led me to study more about what Europe is doing, even beyond the political system and proportional representation, into seeing that, wow, the way they do healthcare is much different than what we do. In fact, they have what I call non-profit healthcare. We have for-profit healthcare, and there's lots of both single payer as well as what another type that France and Germany and Switzerland and Belgium do, which isn't single payer. But what they have in common is they're all non-profit, and that's really the key difference between what we have and what they have. And then also they have things like they've actually redesigned the corporation. A lot of Americans, even on the left, don't realize that corporations in Germany are not the same as corporations in the United States, because, just to give you one example, the workers in Germany get to elect 50% of the members of the board of directors of major corporations, Fortune 500 companies. It would be like if Walmart were allowed to, you know, were required to have its workers elect 50% of its board members. That's what Germany has. Sweden has a version of that. Many countries in Europe have a version of that. So I became fascinated by these differences that I, as an American, knew nothing about, and all the people I knew on the left also knew nothing about, even though we were very much trying to figure out how do we deal with corporations. In fact, we didn't know that, you know, the fourth largest economy in the world, Germany, had redesigned the corporation. And so that struck me as a major oversight in our knowledge. And so I began researching these other differences with Europe, and then eventually incorporated them into the book. So in a nutshell, that's kind of my traveling intellectually over the last 20, 25 years.
No, that's interesting, Stephen, because I didn't know your earlier background before New America. And so to see that where you came, I would think that some of what you were doing prior to New America was considered less mainstream, and yet what you were doing was you were taking your frustration there and saying, you know, what can we do to make this stuff work better? I really appreciated two points you made, Stephen Hill, in that, and one was this thing about redesigning the corporation. I know when we've talked in the past, in America, very often there's this attack from right or left, or this approach from right or left, that there's, you know, capitalism good, corporation good, or capitalism bad, corporation bad. And it turns out that that's a false choice, that what's actually happening, as you point out in these other countries, is they've redesigned the corporation, and in some sense, when you do that, you redesign capitalism in a way that actually makes it much more serve the needs of the people, the workers, the other stakeholders besides the stockholders.
Exactly, and same with healthcare. I one of my frustrations is that we have come up with this false choice in the United States. It's either single payer or it's what we have now, and so many progressives in the United States, even those who are working on healthcare, are completely unaware that there is actually a third way, and it seems to be better than single payer in terms of shorter waits for elective surgeries and other such things. This is what they use in Germany, in France, in Belgium. In fact, in my research for my book Europe's Promise, I encountered this group of Americans who had been living in Europe, many of them for decades, and had lived in many different countries as well as had lived in the United States. And I could ask them, they became kind of my think tank of, you know, what's the best healthcare system in Europe or in even the United States? How would you compare them? They say, oh, well, the United States is the worst, of course. But within Europe, they seem to think that France and Belgium were the best, and they don't use single payer. You know, even those who had lived in the UK and had experienced the UK's single payer system, they felt that the system in France and in Belgium was superior to what they had in the UK. And what they have is basically, as I said before, it's a non-profit system. They actually have private insurance companies as the backbone of Germany and France and Belgium's healthcare systems. But all these private insurance companies are all non-profits. And that right there makes a huge difference. And so I think when we're trying to figure out a way to move forward here in the United States, it makes sense to start in some ways from what you have and where you are. And we already have all these private insurance companies. So the solution suggests that we need to just much more heavily regulate them and even take the profit motive out of healthcare. And then that frees up a lot more options at that point.
And as we know, speaking again specifically about healthcare, Stephen Hill, to some extent, that's a return to the past. In not so much that, but in other words, healthcare was, to a great extent, or at least to a large extent, nonprofit driven for many, many years. It was the religious, the churches, and so on, who had hospitals and insurance. Even I think was less. There were exceptions to the for-profit insurance rule, even, weren't there?
Yes, that's right. They were, you know, like utilities, for example, which also was a heavily regulated industry at one point in the United States. They were allowed to make a certain amount of profit and no more. But like everything else, over the last 20, 25 years in the United States, we deregulated all these industries, and the consequences have been disastrous.
Yeah, and one of the things I think is that what helps make that more disastrous is the other point you point out, which is the thing which your book, Tom Gagin's book, Were You Born on the Wrong Continent, and my own, you know, study over the last couple of years, is, as you point out, even progressives active in a specific area, active in the healthcare area, or progressive active in the labor area, somehow remain ignorant of what works elsewhere, which says to me, A, that Americans have a cultural blind spot to being able to see what's happening, but there must be something else going on that allows the people who, you know, want to find options to not, you know, to not see them when they're there.
Yeah, it is really unfortunate, because I think it keeps us in a straitjacket, and it allows us to be less flexible in our policy approaches. I've talked to, you know, lots of major labor leaders and as well as anti-globalization leaders, including grassroots leaders, and asked them, hey, have you ever heard of this co-determination in Germany where the workers get to elect 50% of the board members? And they either outright didn't know, or some of them were just dismissive. Oh, that just creates company unions, which is ridiculous. They also have a much stronger labor union in these countries, because they have things like co-determination as well as better labor laws. And so it just really seems to me that we've painted ourselves into a corner policy-wise. I mean, we could introduce bills right now in the United States Congress to require that corporations must allow their workers to elect a certain percentage of the members of board of directors. In Germany, it's 50%. In Sweden, it's a third. And this, as you can imagine, there's been lots of research looking at this type of institution, and even asking the members of, the CEOs and what have you, what do you think of this co-determination? And of course, they think it's a pain. They have to deal with it. But they also acknowledge that it gives them certain advantages that their other competitors don't have, like it facilitates much better communication within the company. And so, yeah, sure, they have to come to the workers, and they have to talk about if they're going to do layoffs, what they're going to do, who's going to get laid off. But what that led to in Germany was, instead of laying off millions of people, instead they did something called short work, where they had everybody cut back a little bit. So instead of working 100% full-time, you're working maybe 90 or 85%. And then they had put money away during the good times to make up the loss of wages for having workers working fewer hours. And by keeping their workforce intact that way, it kept their productivity level, their skill level high. It meant you had more workers that had more money in their pocket, because what happens in an economic downturn when you start laying people off is now you have fewer people with money in their pocket. That means businesses have fewer customers, and you get into this downward spiral where, you know, the layoffs beget more layoffs. But in Germany and other places, the Netherlands and others that did this short work, it was an intervention into the downward spiral of an economic recession that prevented it from being so steep. And then another thing that it does is it prevents the utter devastation that happens to communities when you start laying off the major breadwinners, you know, and the devastation that happens to families, increases in alcoholism, mental illness, domestic violence that we've seen in the United States. And yet this didn't really happen in these other countries. And when Larry Summers, who's been one of Barack Obama's closest economic advisors, was asked, hey, why don't we try some of this German short work stuff or co-determination and, you know, these other things that have worked so well, his response was, in America, we're not about saving old jobs. We're about creating new jobs, as if there's some conflict between the two. And I just really think it shows the rigidity of the orthodoxy, the economic orthodoxy in the United States, even though we socialize the gains and privatize the gains and socialize losses when it comes to corporations and banks. But when it comes to time to suspending economic orthodoxy and helping out people, and we even help the macro economy, yet we're still locked into these rigid ideas. And,
yeah.
And Germany and Sweden and other places are actually much more flexible on these things.
The key thing in what you were saying was, I've used that Larry Summers quote many times because it's so indicative, but what's stranger to me, and the thing that I will make this one last question on this, Stephen, which is, you've obviously been looking at this more than I have, but I, for the life of me, can't figure it out. It seems pathological almost, you know, like what is it that that keeps us so blind? And I've looked at it this way, actually. We all pride ourselves on being the greatest can-do society, you know, but can-do doesn't mean you have to invent it. I mean, a real can-do society, or even a can-do corporation, looks at what's out there, sees what's working, and says, how can I adapt that? How can I make it better? What do I trim? What do I add? But you steal like crazy the best ideas from everywhere else. I mean, it's the way you do it. And yet somehow As I say, it isn't just the people in whose interest the status quo is. It seems almost everyone is ignorant of these alternatives.
Yeah, it's certainly true, Terrence. I mean, you can understand why sort of the more mainstream and conservative people, I mean, they're just afraid of change. But people on the left and progressives, it's a bit more shocking there. I mean, even, you know, when you look at progressive leaders like Naomi Klein and Noam Chomsky and others with their anti-corporate analysis, disaster capitalism, all these sorts of things, which is, you know, it certainly is understandable why they advance those views. But there's no nuance there.
No, you can marshal enormous facts in support of that argument, but you can't. You have to omit the alternatives to make the come to their conclusions.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, you know, it would make more sense to look at U.S. corporations, European corporations, Japanese corporations. They're all quite different. In fact, there was a book in the early 90s that was one of my favorite books, and it's called Seven Cultures of Capitalism. And they look at seven different countries and their capitalist cultures and institutions and even the business people and their attitudes. And you can see there is a clear difference between American corporations and French corporations and German corporations. And so I really think that the progressives need to get more sophisticated in our analysis. I mean, the whole corporate personhood movement, which I understand, you know, where they're coming from, but it's basically just a thumb in the eye to the system. The idea that you can revoke a corporation's charter and lose all those jobs and that some other corporation will just fill the void, the gap that's created by the corporation you've just destroyed, I just think it's not likely to yield anything that we find particularly illuminating or moving us forward, and yet changing the very nature of corporations so that they actually are different creatures. This is what they've done in Europe, and it seems to me, and you can do this just by passing laws. I mean, granted, it would be a tough battle, but no tougher than trying to revoke corporate charters. So it seems to me that we should put our efforts into things that are building the positive future instead of just engaging in the thumb in the eye to the system, because that's not really going, it just leaves us blind.
Yeah, right? The other point, you're saying you can do it through laws. The thing that has struck me is that we've had an awful lot of labor negotiations over the last 5 to 10 years in the U.S. where labor has given back things. Either they've solidified gains for the established employees and made things tougher for new employees, you know, very often going for two-tier in terms of health benefits, or they've given back things that they gained over the years. It strikes me that what would have made such a lot of sense would have been, okay, you know, we see your point, we'll give this back. In exchange, we want to elect two members of the board. In exchange for even more, we want four members of the board. And you may know better than I, but I have heard of no one who's done this.
No, I've heard of no one who's done this.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like such a sound negotiation.
And, you know, other members of Congress that you expect would introduce something like this. And even if we don't pass it, it'll take us years to pass something like this, of course. But by introducing that kind of legislation, it changes the conversation.
Yeah. But I'm saying in labor negotiations, you know, you don't need a law. When you're negotiating, you've got things they want, they've got things you want.
Right. I mean, with the whole Occupy Wall Street thing, 1% versus the 99%, it would completely fit into that discussion point of like, okay, the 99% wants representation on these corporate boards of directors, this because they have so much say in what happens to our society. So there's just a complete, it's one step it leads to the other in my view, and I think it would be a better step than let's revoke corporate charters, because I don't see that movement going anywhere. At a certain point, the workers know, hey, that's my job.
Exactly.
You know, when you kill that corporation, that's my job, and the workers themselves are going to fight it.
Right.
I think, you know, having a rally cry, Walmart will allow their workers to elect 50% of the members of the board of directors. That, to me, is something that you can build upon. I mean, they do other things as well. You know, they have what's called works councils. Every job site elects a works council using proportional representation, so it's fully representative of the breadth of opinion there. And they have tremendous say over the day-to-day job conditions. And then on top of that, they have stronger labor unions. So they have just a much more robust, what I call, culture of consultation, where
exactly,
it's just expected. Even the corporate CEOs expect that they're going to have to deal with this layer of things whenever they want to do it. And in fact, you know, it's really interesting if you look at European corporations when they come over to the United States. they don't really act any different than American corporations. A little bit. They do give their employees more more vacation and other things generally. But they don't really act much different because, you know, the laws are different and the regulations are different. And so you really, it's really about the laws and regulations that you have. If you want to change their behavior, you have to have regulations that are going to guide that behavior and create incentives and disincentives that, that push the behavior in a certain direction. And we just don't have them here, and yet they are pioneering this sort of thing in Europe.
Very good. That's the voice of Stephen Hill. We're talking about some of the ideas in his book, Europe's Promise. But let's move for a second here, Stephen, to, again, still talk about Europe, but talk about the current situation in Europe. In other words, here you come out with a book that says Europe works better than we do. And the book has lots of numbers and ideas and so on that demonstrate it. But for the last, I looked, and the last time I interviewed you was March 2010. So we're talking basically 2 years ago. And you can see that this issue of Europe under siege as far as Greek debt, Spanish debt, Italian debt, Irish debt, and so on, has been going on now for quite a while. Where do you see that issue right now? And the way I put it at the top was, you know, how close are they to solving it? How close are they to blowing it?
Well, you can pretty much erase 85% of what people have read about what's going on in Europe. You have to keep in mind that the major media, they reflect the values of the business community, and they reflect the values of stockholders. And, you know, the major media are themselves for-profit corporations. So they look at this all in terms of, are we going to get paid back by countries that have borrowed lots of money, or businesses or banks that have borrowed lots of money? And that's completely how they look at it. They don't look at it from the point of view of how is it working for the average person in Europe. And I think that you have to change the frame to some degree to understand what's going on there. The other thing that it's important to realize is that what's at bottom, what's going on in Europe is they are in the process of deciding how united they want to be, how much of a union do they want to have. And that process is going to take literally decades to play out. It's not going to happen overnight. I think they are coping with it actually pretty well, but you have to have a long-term view of this. I mean, if you think about our own country in 1789, at our founding, we did not have a single currency. Every state had its own currency. Even banks had their own scripts. And when the first Secretary of the Treasury, Alexander Hamilton, created the dollar and created what we would recognize as a modern financial system, that his efforts were fiercely fought by Thomas Jefferson and James Madison, two other of the leading founding fathers. In addition, I mean, when they were trying to tax, you know, part of what's going on in Europe is the whole decision about how centralized, how much of a central and federal government should they have for Europe as a whole, and then the member states would, to some degree, give some of their sovereignty to this federal central government. Well, when the United States first formed, you know, they tried to think of, well, we need to have raise some money for the federal government, but because of no taxation without representation, they were very reluctant to pass any taxes because it was going to be very, very, opposed by certain powerful interests. And so they thought, well, what could we tax that would just, like, not raise very much of a ruckus? And they thought, oh, we'll come up with a whiskey tax. We'll tax whiskey. Surely no one will go berserk over that. Well, in fact, in western Pennsylvania, they did go berserk. They rounded up the tax collectors. They had a mini insurrection, and President Washington had to march troops to western Pennsylvania to put down what was essentially an insurrection. And in fact, I could go through decade after decade and show you how, like in the early 1800s, certain member states, if we want to call them in the United States, were bankrupt, like Greece is today, and they had to deal with that. And in fact, we fought a civil war 70 years after our nation's founding over the issue of states' rights, which at its most basic was about states versus central government. And slavery was one of the major issues of states' rights, but it wasn't by any means the only one. And so this is what Europe is going through. And it's not going to be settled overnight. And you're going to see, Europe, since this crisis has begun, I mean, and they knew when the Eurozone was established and when, after the Maastricht Treaty in the early 90s, when they founded the European Union, they knew that there were certain defects in their fiscal union. and that at some point they would have to deal with them. But that was as much of a union they could get at that time. So they had to kick that can down the road. And they didn't expect that it would emerge in such spectacular fashion as what's happening over Greece and the Italy and Portugal. But they also didn't expect that we'd have the biggest economic collapse since the Great Depression. So a lot of what's going on right now is in reaction to that, and they're having to basically, you know, pull out new solutions one after the other as each new part of this crisis emerges.
Well, let me ask a couple, because you, in terms of the long term, which is the way you sort of phrase that, you're saying this is, you know, this is difficult, but this kind of thing should be expected to be difficult. And it's, and you do think, however, that that some kind of United States of Europe is inevitable.
Yes, that's what it's clearly that's what's happening.
Okay.
It may not look exactly like what we have, but that's what's happening. They've just passed, for example, agreed to a compact in which they all the member states are going to have to keep their budgets and their deficits above below a certain amount, and if they don't, they can be penalized. And you know, a lot of the people that are really worried about what's happening in Europe are portraying this as they're calling it a death trap. They're really using all sorts of hyperbole to describe this. But in fact, that's what we have in the United States. 49 out of 50 states right now have some sort of requirement that they must have a balanced budget either year after year or within a few years. California, of course, is going through. We're slashing all sorts of things because we have to try to get close to a balanced budget. So they're putting in place the very things that we already have in this United States of America. And once they have that in place, so that's solidified, then you're going to see other things coming to place. Like, for example, the European Central Bank will become more of a financial backstop like the Federal Reserve, where the Federal Reserve can assume all the debt that we have in the United States continent-wide and can guarantee that debt so that it doesn't lead the bonds markets to think that they're not going to get paid back, which leads to the speculation and the high interest rates on bonds and these sorts of things. And then you're also going to see what's known as a transfer union. And they already have somewhat of one, but not nearly as much as we have. And what that means, you know, if you take states like California and New York, for every dollar in federal taxes Californians and New Yorkers send to the federal government, they get back about 70 cents. Where does that other 30 cents go? It goes to states like Alabama, Mississippi, Wyoming, Alaska that receive a lot more of federal funding per capita than any other states. And so basically in a transfer union, the better off states, the higher tax states, help out the states that aren't doing so well. Without that feature, Mississippi and Alabama would be absolute backwaters, even more than some people consider them today. So in essence, Greece is Europe's Mississippi.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people thought Greece had a standard of living and had a country that worked like Western Europe, and it turns out it doesn't. It's more like Eastern Europe. It's more like Romania and Bulgaria. They ran up huge amounts of debt that they couldn't sustain, they couldn't pay for, to the point where the people who lent them the money originally said, you know what, we're not going to lend you any more money. And so Greece was going to, if its European partners hadn't stepped in and agreed to loan them more money with conditions attached, Greece would be in far worse shape than it's in right now. You would have already seen a bank run. You would have seen all sorts of money leaving that country. You would have seen people being laid off in a much more massive numbers than has already occurred. So Greece is in a tough spot as they basically downsize to their economy to what they actually can produce.
One thing I haven't heard, Stephen, and give me a brief answer to this because I want to do sort of our halfway through the hour turnaround, but Western Europe, the well-off countries, have, in a sense, been through a little bit of this already, integrating the Eastern countries, haven't they? And they survived that one. Is there something, that they learned from that works now, or are they completely different?
No, it's very similar. I mean, they're basically putting Greece on a type of program that they originally put on, like, Romania and Bulgaria. And including, you know, those were countries that also had a lot of corruption, like Greece does, people not paying their taxes, not just the wealthy, but even just everyday people. And, you know, there was all sorts of, under the table type of economic activity, black market activity in Greece. And so these are sorts of things they're saying to Greece, look, you can't do this anymore. This is hurting you. It's making you, if a modern economy has to do one thing, it has to be able to count. You know, you have to be able to know how much revenue you have coming in and what you can spend that revenue on to create services and resources for your people. And if you can't count, then you can't be sure of anything. And so Greece is I mean, in many ways, you know, Germany and the ECB and IMF have taken a lot of criticism for Greece. And I think they actually are Greece's best friend because they're giving Greece an opportunity to get their act together.
Yeah, to get real, to grow up, that sort of thing, in terms of...
Greece is, you know, this is a country that hit its debt with the help of Goldman Sachs.
That's right.
And they're saying you can't do this stuff anymore. If you want to be in the Eurozone, you want to be in the EU, you can't do that. And in addition, you need to find out, you know, invest in your people and make them more productive. I mean, labor costs in Greece are 30% higher than they are in Germany. And yet Greece has nothing that they produce really that the world wants to buy. That's a big problem.
Right.
And they've got to figure out a solution. And I think the European partners are very much willing to help them figure it out, but they have to be willing to do it themselves first. It's kind of like, you know, the old joke of how many Europeans does it take to change a light bulb if the light bulb is Greece? Well, the light bulb has to want to change.
That's right. Okay, I'm Terrence McNally. That's Stephen Hill. He's the author of Europe's Promise, the book we've been talking about, Why the European Way is the Best Hope for an Insecure Age, and the just-released 2012 election edition, which will turn our attention to 10 Steps to Repair American Democracy. And you can learn more about all of Stephen's work. He blogs, you know, in between all these books and so on, at Stephen-Hill.com, and that's Stephen with a V. S-T-E-V-E-N, Stephen-Hill, H-I-L-L.com. Let me ask one last thing on the Europe question, which is the austerity versus stimulus question. Is Europe taking too long to pivot on this? In other words, on the one hand, they're facing the huge deficits. On the other hand, they're not moving quickly in terms of momentum. And are they playing this right, or are they sticking with austerity too long?
I think on the whole, they're playing it right. We're starting to see the pivot now. You're seeing a lot more talk now about the need to, in fact, over this recent pact that they've negotiated about, you know, keeping the deficits and debt within a certain range and these sorts of things. There are now the Social Democrats, both in Germany, and the Socialists in France are starting to saying, okay, fine, we understand we need to do that, but we want to combine that with certain measures to stimulate growth and stimulate job creation. And that conversation is starting to pick up more and more. You're hearing more and more on both the left and the right in Europe saying, yeah, that's what we have to do. Even Mario Monti, the prime minister of Italy, who's a conservative, is saying we've got to have more job creation. And I think it's definitely coming. It may have to wait until the German election in 2013. I'm not sure that Chancellor Angela Merkel for Germany, who's the center-right chancellor, you know, she's done, I think, a number of things, moving her party in these sorts of directions, moving it more towards the United States of Europe. But I'm not sure that she's going to be the one that can actually hit the button for more stimulus. So I think, and the polls show that, and there'll be a major state election in Germany in this May, in which we'll see that in some ways it's the largest population state in Germany having its election. And right now the polls are showing that what they call a red-green coalition is going to emerge, the Social Democrats and the Green Party. And the polls are showing nationally that's what's going to emerge as well in Germany. And then in France right now, the Socialist is ahead of Nicolas Sarkozy, the president, those polls. Though I think that's going to be a very close race. But even so, you're seeing a lot more people recognizing, okay, the austerity was necessary to some degree. We had to get everybody sort of at a certain base level and then start building from there. But I think that more and more people now saying we're at that point. It's time to start moving and incorporating these other things. So I think you're going to see that. But again, when I say you're going to see that over the next year, 2 years.
Yeah, that's what when you say after the 2013 election, that seems like a long time. If you know.
And that's where I think people have to realize that, you know, we're used to things changing in our own individual lives on the order of days, weeks, months, but society's changed on the order of decades. And you're seeing a major a major societal shift in Europe of what's going on towards this, basically a confederation of states as it's been to a United States of Europe. And again, if you think about our own history, even though we had 1789, it took decades to fill in the details of that. It took certain presidents being elected who helped to define what a president does and what the U.S. Congress does. These sorts of institutions do take decades to fill in the features of how they're really going to work rather than what's just written on paper.
Yeah, I'm going to shift now to the U.S., but what I'm saying is I understand the time axis for changing institutions and for developing this United States of Europe. I'm not sure that the government's investing in, you know, their economies can wait that long. That's all I'm saying. It seems that it looks to me like those should be on two different time tracks. But I know what you're saying is that you have a feeling that, in fact, it will take people feeling comfortable with their integration before they make that shift wholeheartedly.
Right. But keep in mind, even right now, it's not every country in Europe that's experiencing these problems. In fact, most countries in Europe are doing quite well. A country like Poland has never went into recession.
That's right.
They're hosting the world's European Soccer Championship. They're building stadiums, new roads. There's all sorts of economic stimulus going on in countries in Eastern and Central Europe. I was in Czech Republic not that long ago. They're doing remarkably well, considering that we've been through this economic crisis of historic proportions. Sweden is doing incredibly well. You know, old socialist Sweden, as people, you know, American ideologues like to bash Sweden for years, and yet Sweden is doing much better than we are doing here in the United States. Germany has an unemployment rate of about 5%.
Very good. So, okay, you've just added nuance to what I was asking. What you're saying is that when you say that it will take integration to prompt stimulation, you're saying before they start stimulating Greece or Italy or the ones that are having the real problems, but that the countries that have the capacity are already making that shift.
They're already making
very
that
good.
Shift. And just keep in mind that everybody in all these countries already has health care.
That's
they
right.
already have more generous retirement pensions than what we have with Social Security. I mean, they already have things that Americans, progressives in particular, are trying to get. Even everyone in Greece still has health care.
That's right.
There's been a decrease in the quality of that health care for sure. But, you have to keep these things in perspective. In some ways, it's apples and oranges, these comparisons, because they're cutting back some of their support system for families and individuals, no question about that in Europe. But they start from a place of so much more generosity and so much more robustness that it's hard for Americans to even conceive of the difference. I mean, you know, they have way more vacation. I mean, when I was in Sweden and I was getting a ride to the airport by the Swedes who were hosting my talk there, they were on their way out of town on vacation. And in addition to getting, you know, vacation pay, which most Americans get, not all, a lot of Americans do not get any vacation pay when they go out of town on vacation, they were having deposited into their account money to have a good time on vacation, extra money. And every Swede gets this. And so, I could go through example after example. Child care, where we're paying at least six times as much money per capita per child for child care. Health care, we're paying twice as much money per capita for health care than they do in Germany, Belgium, France, Sweden, on and on and on. In just so many ways, their system is not just more generous, but it's more efficient and more cost-effective. It's costing them less money to provide health care than what we're paying in the United States. I mean, you know, health care is going to bankrupt this country.
Yeah, I mean, that's a whole other show.
And they've solved that problem.
Yeah.
And yet we're not learning from them.
Yeah. I mean, as you said before, if anyone wasn't listening at the top, one of the keys is that it is not the false choice of single payer versus the current American system. The way it is done around the world has many, many varieties. The key thing seems to be whether there's profit to be made dealing with the health of your citizens or not.
Right.
That's the voice of Stephen Hill. We're going to shift now to his recently released 2012 election edition of 10 Steps to Repair American Democracy. Why the new version?
Well,
your book originally came out in 2006.
Right. So it's an updated version. It also puts it into the context of what happened with this economic collapse, and it basically makes the point that reform is more urgent and more necessary than ever. because before this economic collapse occurred, we had a long-standing political collapse. And so it looks at what caused that collapse, and then, and it's, but it's very much a solutions-oriented book. I mean, there's so many books out there that, you know, define what the problem is and what happened, and Jacob Hacker and Paul Pearson's book and others. But, you know, not too many of them have much in the way of solutions. And if they do talk about solutions, they just say, well, we need more campaign finance reform. And it's, and I wish it were that simple. It's actually the crisis in American democracy is much more severe than that. And, in fact, I'm much more worried about the United States than I am about Europe, because in Europe you see, you know, things are happening in a noisy fashion and in a somewhat haphazard fashion, but there's movement there. In the United States, there's really no movement. We're at a point of stasis, paralysis, polarization, where no one can move, and the major issues of our day are not being solved because the political system is so broken. So this book addresses, it helps to understand why it's so broken, and once we understand why, then we can talk about what to do about it. And so it has these 10 steps for solutions, and at the end of each chapter, which is a step, it has organizations that are working on
each of these solutions. Yeah, yeah, I wanted to read one quote from your
manual. You know, people, roll up your sleeves. Let's get to work, because we have got to change American democracy and move into the 21st century.
Yeah, let me make a comment that you don't have to respond to, but in the foreword of your book by Hendrik Hertzberg, he makes a good point, which it seems to me is some, in some ways, the counterpoint to what we've been saying about Americans not knowing about the alternative solutions for healthcare or the corporation or so on, and so thus not doing them. He points out that around the world, democracy has never been more popular or prevalent than it is today. But when new democracies emerge, as they did in the 90s from Prague to Pretoria, the American model, apart from the Bill of Rights, is almost universally rejected. Our geographically based, plurality, winner-take-all method of representation serves us especially poorly. It's why control of the House and Senate is decided in a dozen districts and a half dozen states. So it is interesting that while we are blind to alternatives that might serve us well, the other point of that is that we also hold to the fact that our system is perfect. The Founding Fathers were perfect. We are the best, the most perfect democracy ever. And in fact, what's happened is that everywhere else around the world that has chosen democracy after us, no one has copied our system exactly. Some people copy certain things, but basically the notion that in 200 years, 200 plus years now, you couldn't improve on something that had never been done before, right? That you were the first ones to do it, that you would hit it perfectly and not need to improve it, is pretty crazy.
Yeah, in fact, other countries like New Zealand, which used many of our methods for 150 or so years, recently have evolved to go to more modern methods like proportional representation. Even the UK, which we consider our closest ally in many ways in the world, they're in the process of a rather impressive evolution away from these winner-take-all practices to a more representative democracy. So it's, U.S. is the one that's really quite stuck, and we constantly refer back to the founders and framers and say, you know, this is what they created, it's holy, it's sacred. And actually, Hendrik Hertzberg, in the preface to my book, says, you know, actually, what distinguishes the founders and framers is not that they created something that's sacred and holy, because actually, if you read the annals of the discussion at that time of the Constitutional Convention, what comes across clearest is that they were completely confused. They didn't know what they were doing. They, you know, certain proposals that they voted in one day, they would vote out 2 weeks later, and then they'd vote in another version of the original proposal 2 weeks after that. Throughout that long, hot summer, they had numerous proposals, and what they finally came up with at the end was a last-ditch effort, because they'd been meeting for months, they were tired, they wanted to go home, and they said, oh, heck with it, let's just try this. So it wasn't the brilliance of the founders and framers, but it was more just, you know, they finally came up with something that they thought might work, and they would give it a try. But within two election cycles, they had to pass a couple of constitutional amendments to cover up the defects of what they originally had created. So we shouldn't be so wedded. What the founders and framers, what distinguishes them is that they were creative. They were outside-the-box thinkers. And we need to be outside-the-box thinkers today. In fact,
exactly. In other words, not to enshrine what they did, but to model and imitate who they were, which is people that were innovators, that were chance takers, that were risk takers, that were negotiators, and all of that sort of thing. So let's turn to, if I were to say, you've got 8 minutes to take on two or three of your solutions and make sense of them. Pick whichever two or three you want. So basically the book, 10 Steps to Repair American Democracy, has 10, but pick two or three.
Well, I'll pick a couple of easy ones, easier ones, and then ones that would be more, a little more difficult but more profound. First one would be, I would say, is universal voter registration. The United States is rather alone in the world in the laws, the Byzantine laws we erect to basically prevent people from being registered to vote. And if, as a result, we have about 25% to 30% of Americans who are eligible to vote but aren't registered. In the rest of the world, they have what's called universal or automatic voter registration. If you are 18, eligible to vote, you are automatically registered. And you don't have to do anything. You don't have to sign any cards. You're automatically registered. They send you something in the mail saying, congratulations, here's where you vote. And if we did something like that, we would add a lot more people to the rolls. And the people who we would add to the rolls disproportionately are young people, minorities, poor people. These are the people that are being shut out of our political system. As a result, the policies and the legislatures reflect that. And so that would be one that, and this could be done on a state-by-state basis. And in fact, it's kind of ironic, I say this to Democrats in particular, because universal voter registration is the right thing to do, it's the fair thing to do, and it also would benefit the Democratic Party, because the people who aren't registered tend to be people who are more open to voting Democrats. So especially in those states that Democrats control, they should be all over this, passing this, and advancing this issue, and yet they don't. And to me, it's just incredibly stupid. The Democrats can't get their heads around this, and I think it's just because, you know, Democrats, if you're an elected legislator, you think, well, the rules that elected me must be
right. Right. In other words, what you're saying is that the incumbency, the incumbent party, the party of incumbency, overrides the party of democracy.
Exactly. And yeah. So it's really unfortunate because all, you know, a lot of young people, minorities, are kept off the rolls by the Byzantine laws we have.
Yeah.
And, you know, other countries are already doing it in a much different way. The other thing I would say would be extremely important, of course, is campaign finance reform, public financing, free media time. Again, this is what just about every established democracy in the world already has. Also, a more robust public broadcasting sector. The BBC is just light years ahead of public broadcasting in the United States, both in terms of the programming they do, the quality of their journalists, as well as their funding. I mean, the BBC is getting about $60 per capita for funding, and public broadcasters get about $3 per capita. And
let me just frame that for people that don't know that. Britain has commercial broadcasting networks now. For a while they didn't, but they do.
Rupert Murdoch.
Right, exactly. That's. But the public broadcasting is a fee for everyone who owns a television or everyone who owns a radio, right?
That's right.
And you're saying it's $60 per person in the UK?
No, per capita. So what that works out to is they pay about $15, maybe $20 a month. It's sort of like what we pay for cable in the United States, except they pay it for public broadcasting, and they get numerous channels, they get radio programs as a result of this subscription, and everyone has to subscribe. If you have a TV or a radio, you have to subscribe. So it gives them a much more stable base than what we have in the United States, where you have the Congress that basically dangles funding in front of PBS if they, you know, basically don't – they sing the tune of their masters, so to speak. So I think that this – it would not only the increase in funding, but the mechanism for funding of monthly household subscriptions rather than allocations from Congress makes a huge difference. And this is not just Britain, but ARD in Germany, ORF in Austria. You know, all these different countries have this type of mechanism with much more robust public broadcast.
When you talk about public financing of campaigns, I saw Lawrence Lessig speak this week. His model, he now believes this is the issue, that all other issues rest on this issue, and I basically agree. As you say, there's much more than that. In other words, we could change campaign finance, and the filibuster would still be what
it is. Yeah, I mean, let me just, because I know we're running out of time, let me just challenge that a little bit. I mean, I have helped to pass public financing. I'm a public finance advocate. But unfortunately, many people invest too much in that reform and what it's capable of doing. And I'll give you just one example.
Good.
I mean, the United States Congress, even in 2010, in which there was a turnover from Democrats to Republicans, about two-thirds of seats were won by landslides. And it's not because the candidates, the winners in those districts had more money. It's because the district is a Republican district or a Democratic district. I live in San Francisco. Nancy Pelosi is my representative. There is no chance for a Republican or a Green Party or any other point of view to beat Nancy Pelosi, not because she has more money, but because there's too many Democrats in this district. You can't change people's minds by having a ton more money. And it turns out that most elections in the United States, not only at congressional level, at legislative level, but also, you know, many states are virtual one-party monoliths, where it's impossible for the other party to win. Even if you gave them more money, they wouldn't win because they just aren't enough voters in that state, and you can't fool people that much. So, I mean, yes, campaign finance reform, public financing is important, but if we're really going to open up this political system, the key to transforming American democracy, in my view, is proportional representation. We have to get away from this winner-take-all, if I win, you lose system, one district at a time getting elected, where we know this district is going to elect a Democrat, we know this district is going to elect a Republican. And instead, with proportional representation, if a party wins, say, 20% of the popular vote, instead of getting nothing like you get in our system, you get 20% of the seats. If a party gets 40% of the vote, you get 40% of the seats. If a party gets 60% of the vote, instead of winning 100% of the representation like you do in our winner-take-all system, you get only 60% of the seats. And this is what creates multi-party democracy, where you could have a Democratic Party, Republican Party, you could have a Green Party, you could have a Libertarian Party, you could have a multi-party system all winning seats in the legislature. And that, and it also does a bunch of other good things, because it introduces new ideas into your politics. The minor parties is where the new ideas, they're essentially the laboratory for new ideas that introduces new ideas, and then the mainstream parties start having to interact with those ideas because they can lose votes now to the minor parties if they don't come up with a position. And that's how the Green Party in Germany has risen to the point of a small minor party that no one had ever heard of before, to the point where they now hold the governorship of the most prosperous state in Germany. And it's because they were able to advance new ideas year after year, not only on environment, but also on green economy, anti-nuclear, civil rights for gays, all sorts of things. The Green Party has been that party in Germany and other countries in Europe because they have proportional representation. In the United States, the Green Party doesn't win anything, really, to speak of, except...
So let me stay with that one one more minute, okay? How do we make that happen? Because I think for many of these things, it's like, well, that would be nice, but as you say, the hard part is actually getting people to from that would be nice to actually making it happen. How would proportional representation happen?
You just need to pass a law. So, I mean, in California, we could pass a law at the state level changing the single-member district winner-take-all system to proportional representation. There's different ways to configure it, and so you'd have to have a good discussion about how to do that. But it comes down to just changing the laws. And
so what it comes down to then is, since we know that incumbents – seem to have this default thing to what elected me is the best way, it would really take a lot of grassroots activism to make something like that happen.
Grassroots activism, voter initiative. I mean, you know, Molly Munger, she's putting a lot of money into a voter initiative because she's frustrated with the legislature. I would say to Molly, put all your money into changing the legislature. Let's get different representatives there that have different priorities, different values, and that will pass different policy. That's what we need in California and in the United States in general.
Very good. I'm going to have to close this conversation at this point. The two books we talked about are Europe's Promise and the 2012 election edition of 10 Steps to Repair American Democracy, and you can learn more about both of them at Stephen with a V, Stephen-Hill, HILL.com. Finally, thank you to Stephen Hill. Keep up the good work.
Pleasure, Karen, as always.